Once again, our topic for today is of Queen and Quarrel, Queen Shlomzion and Sectarian Disputes of the Hasmonean Era. When I left my children this morning to come to YU to give the class, they asked me, where are you going? I said, I'm giving a lecture today. And, sorry. Now, can you hear me? Okay. So my oldest turned to me and said, what are you lecturing on? I gave him the topic and he said, Mommy, can you say that in English? So just to introduce the topic in a more, I guess, mundane fashion in terms of what we'll be discussing today, what I figured we would discuss in a period such as now, where we're kind of approaching Hanukkah, is put ourselves back in the period when the story of Hanukkah began and the aftermath of the Hanukkah story. Why did I choose Hanukkah? Because, of course, right after Sukkot ended, what do I get in my inbox? I check my email, and I have something from this company selling presents for Hanukkah, this company saying, do you have, you know, your Hanukkah cards ready? So I figured if everyone else is getting ready in terms of present shopping and your Hanukkah cards getting ready and you have your menorah, do you have everything set for Hanukkah, maybe I should start thinking about what happened in that period as well to get ourselves in the mindset of what took place during that era. So we'll begin with the first source. And the first source is a little chart of the figures in history that were around in the period that we refer to as the Hashmonai era. So those of us familiar with the Hanukkah story, I think everyone in this room, knows that the story happens, the Jews celebrate the victory over the Greeks, and we celebrate as well the miracle that happened with the oil, and the Jews once again are able to rededicate the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, and then we go on living. But I wanted to take us a little bit more in depth in the period. What actually happened? What were the events leading up to Hanukkah? What happened after the miracle with the oil, the battles? And what happened after you have Matisyahu gone, Yehuda Maccabee gone, the Maccabee brothers gone? What happens after that? That's a topic that we kind of don't study that much on a daily basis, or a regular basis, I should say, in the classroom. We don't really have that much material that you find being read about it, but it is an interesting piece of history, and it's also something that I personally think that we should learn about so that we don't repeat what happens in the era following the miracle of Hanukkah. So we'll begin with the first source, where you have the first figure in history at this top of the chart, Matisyahu. You see here, he died approximately 166-165 BCE. That is also approximately when, we say 165-164 BCE, is when the miracle of oil occurred. So what were the events leading up to the Hanukkah story? So we have to understand the context of this era. Who were the Jews living during the Hanukkah story? Were they all the same? Did they all keep Judaism, as we refer to, in the quote-unquote orthodox sense? Were they all adherers to both oral law and written law? Or were there some who were only adherents to the written law? So, but we know from history that there were many types of Jews during this era. Two in particular, the most famous, are... Yes, the Pharisees and the Tzaddikis, okay? The Pharisees believing in Torah Sheba'al Peh and Torah Shebaktav, the Tzaddikim believing in Torah Shebaktav, exactly, okay? So leading up to the Hanukkah story, we know that we have two different factions. There were other factions we can talk about a little bit, but I'm not going to mention it for purposes of time. We don't have the Essenes and the Dead Sea sect. Some say they're the same, some say they differ, but that's a whole different lecture, but not for now. But we know that there was sectarian Judaism. Not every Jew looked alike. Not every Jew was acting the same way. Not every Jew believed in the same way of fulfilling the word of God. But in addition to the different ways that the Jews fulfilled the mitzvot, there were also political rifts that took place in this era. In the camp of the Pharisees, the Jews were combating something that existed in society. Anyone know what was that something that they were combating?
Mityavnim,
exactly. They were combating Hellenism. They were combating, in essence, secularization. The Greeks had conquered Israel, Judea, in 332 BCE, all the way back. And the Jews had been living under Greek rule while they were living in Judea, and of course within the diaspora as well. And the Jews living in Judea under Greek rule gradually started to pick up some of the culture of the Hellenistic world. Now the Tzidukim gladly accepted the culture of the Hellenistic world. In fact, when we get to the period leading up to the story of Hanukkah, by the time we reach approximately 198, particularly when we get to 175 when Antiochus IV takes over, who is the villain in the Hanukkah story, we have the Tzidukim actually requesting that Judea become a Greek polis, a Greek city-state. Okay, so you have, on the one hand, you have the Pharisees, who are in essence saying that the Jews should maintain their Jewishness to the utmost extent, and they're trying to combat the culture around them. On the other hand, you have the Tzidukim. You have those who don't necessarily adhere to the oral law. They're not listening to the words of the rabbis. And additionally, they're trying to take the Greek culture and enforce it on the people, the residents of Judea. We know that leading up to the story of Hanukkah, we have the situation in which the position of Kohen Gadol is bought and sold. That never before in history had happened in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but unfortunately that does happen. And eventually, the last individual before we have the Maccabean revolt, Matthias and his sons revolting, he buys the position of Kohen Gadol and he says, I'll throw in an additional 150 talents of silver if you make Jerusalem into a Greek city. And that's what he says to Antiochus IV. And of course, Antiochus IV is a smart man and he realizes I not only want to change Jerusalem and have it under Greek rule, but if I turn it into a city-state, that will only help me. We know Antiochus IV tried to do that in every area, every territory he conquered, because the more people look like you and act Greek, the easier it is to rule them. The more they keep to their own culture, the harder it is to keep everyone together under your reign. So along comes Antiochus IV, working together, unfortunately, with the Tzidukim Kohen Gadol, and they start introducing and forcibly introducing Greek culture into Jerusalem, into Judean society as a whole. Along comes Matthias, the same story that we see recorded in Sefer Maccabeim, in the Maccabean books. We have the story of Matthias who witnesses a scene in which a Jew is being forced to slaughter the pig, and everyone can yell out the line that Matthias yells as he goes, what is that? Me, exactly. Mi l'Hashem Elai, and he himself goes and he, what does he do? Famous story of being a Maccabee. Exactly. Okay? He kills the individual who's going to sacrifice the pig, and therein lies the beginning of the Maccabean revolt, and we're going to take up from there. What happens after? So Matthias clearly, and those who followed him, and we know, and I'll pose the question in terms of the Jews who would have followed those who were revolting against the Syrian Greeks, okay? The Greeks, a powerful military. Who were the Jews that had the bravery enough to go against such a powerful army? Who were these Jews? Were they the urban Jews? Were they the peasantry? What? It's the peasantry, those who are committed to their Judaism. The city dwellers as a whole, not everyone, but the city dwellers were influenced by the gymnasiums that were built in the Judean cities. They were influenced, the Greek culture was being infused into their society, as opposed to those who lived and did their life as they always did. And they were able to keep their commitment to Judaism. And when Matthias needs to gather forces, how is the battle won? Through guerrilla warfare, through the heart and soul of the people who are fighting for their land, for the holiness of their land. So Matthias and his sons, they, in 165, 164 BCE, the story of Hanukkah takes place. We are able to rededicate the temple, able to rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. The story of the Hanukkah oil happens, where it lasts for 8 days. And then what happens? So we see here Yehuda Maccabee. He dies in approximately 160 BCE. We know that the battle doesn't actually end with the Hanukkah story. It goes on for years afterwards. The Seleucid Empire wanted to, make a treaty with the Jews and allow the Jews to live peacefully under their rule. However, once the Maccabees were victorious in defeating the Greeks, they weren't going to stop there. They wanted not only religious autonomy, to return to the days where they can run the temple, run the Beis HaMikdash without having to go to the king of the Greeks and say, can we buy the position? They wanted political autonomy as well. They wanted Israel. So this period begins what we refer to as an era of both political and religious autonomy in the land of Israel, which when it ends, sadly enough, in 63 BCE, we see here after Jewish civil war, when is the next time in history that the Jews are able to achieve an era like the Hashmonaiah era, where the Jews have both political and religious autonomy? 1948. Exactly. Okay? So, to study this period in history is to study another era, which we fortunately are living in a period where we have the land of Israel. The land of Israel is in our own hands. And this is the Hashmonaiah era, when we are no longer under Greek rule, Persian rule before them, Babylonian rule before them, Roman rule after. But now the Hashmonaiah era is actually being run by Jews for Jews. And sadly enough, we're going to explore the situation that occurred when the political and religious autonomy is restored to the Jews. So you have here Yehuda Maccabee, and then there's Yonatan and Shimon. For three of Matasyahu's sons, for all three of them, they all ruled under Pharisee control. We know that Matasyahu and his children were all Perushim. They adhered to both the oral law and the written law. The problem occurs when Shimon becomes what he refers to as himself as an ethnarch. He takes both the position of the Kohen Gadol and king, and he becomes one. And from Shimon down, until we have the era when the Hashmonaiah family is no longer in control of Israel exclusively, the Hashmonaiah family rule as both the religious leader and the political leader, both the king and the Kohen Gadol. So after Shimon, when he is assassinated, his son takes over, as you see here, John Hyrcanus. And John Hyrcanus actually is a Pharisee for the majority of his life. So from Matasyahu down to his three sons, down to John Hyrcanus, to continue in the ways of allowing all of the procedures of the Beis HaMikdash to continue on through as adherence to both the oral law and the written law. However, during this period, the Tzidukim are gaining more and more control politically. Not only that, but we know that the culture, the Greek culture, is extremely difficult to avoid. There is the thrill of the gymnasium, the sport activities, the theater, the overall culture that Greek society offered to the world was something that was very attractive. We know not only for the Jews, but in every society that the Greeks came in, they were a very attractive culture. And that was something that was leading, unfortunately, many of the Jews, particularly in the city, astray. And John Hyrcanus, as we see here, Yochanan Hyrcanus, he, at the end of his life, will change from Pharisee to the camp of the Tzidukim. When he becomes a Tzidukim, it obviously influences his children. The first of his children is Aristobulus I, who reigns for but a year and then passes away. And then the reign goes over to Alexander Yanai, who is really the topic of the discussion we're going to get into a little bit more in depth. He is married to Shlomit Alexandra, who's AKA known as Queen Shlomtzion. We know that Queen Shlomtzion was the sister of, anybody? Shimon ben Sheta, exactly. So Queen Shlomtzion was the sister of Shimon ben Sheta, and if you want to cheat a little bit to the last source, you see who is this Shimon ben Sheta, why is he relevant, why am I mentioning him? Because he was one of the members of the Zugot. He was in the period that we refer to as the period before the Tanaim, the religious leaders in the period of the Hashmonai era. He was one of the leaders, as we see here in the chart on its source number 7. See here, the first person in this role filled the role of the Nasi, the political leader, while the second person filled the role of the Av Beit Din. So we see here clearly Shimon ben Shetach, who is Alexander Yanai's brother-in-law, Shlomit Alexander's sister. He was the Av Beit Din in this period. Now what happens with Alexander Yanai? Well, he had a father who had been a Pharisee for the majority of his life, but at the end of his life, at the end of his days, he turns over to the Tzidduki camp, no longer adhering to both the oral law and the written law. How does this affect Alexander Yanai, and how does Alexander Yanai's behaviors affect the Jewish world in the Hashmonai era? So that brings us to our next source, source number two. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this tells us of a situation that occurred within this period. And we have here in the underline of Nei Kishayu Hatsidukin Yoshvin, Bisahedron Shelehem, Yanai Hamelech, Bishlomim, Hamalka, Bishavet Slovalohaya, Hami Israel Yoshid, Mehem Hutz, Mishima Ben Shetel. Okay, so we can derive a couple of things here. Who is sitting in the Sanhedrin? Sanhedrin Shel Sidukin. One thing, unfortunately, we find in this era is that the end of Yochanan Horkanus' life and within Alexander Yanai's life, who begins to sit on the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin being the religious body of the Jewish people. Who is sitting and dictating the law of the Jews? Sidukim, okay? Along comes Queen Shlomzion with her brother being Shimon ben Shetach, and they arrive at an occasion where they're sitting at the Sanhedrin, and who do they see? But it is a Sanhedrin of Sidukim. Fast forward to the next underline, okay, and this, the middle, which we don't have time to go through all of the sources, unfortunately, but the middle of the source actually discusses the event in which Shimon ben Shetach is sitting there, and he says, well, why don't we do a little bit of a test? Why don't we see, you know, if those who are sitting on this Sanhedrin can answer particular Shiloh? So he starts one by one, he asks a member of the Sanhedrin, can you answer, you know, whatever the halacha is? And that Siduki member of the Sanhedrin says, I'll look it up and get back to you tomorrow. Doesn't show up the next day to the Sanhedrin. One by one, story goes that Shimon ben Shetach does this to every individual member of the Sanhedrin, says, I have this question, what is the halacha? The Siduki member of the Sanhedrin goes, I'll look it up, doesn't come back the next day. So what happens at the end? V'hemid Shimon ben Shetach, echad min ha-tamidim v'hoshivu b'mkomo, amar lehem ein potim ka-sanhedrin shel din v'echad, v'kach haya oseh lehem v'chol yom v'yom ad sh'nistalku kulam v'yashva sanhedrin Yisrael al da'ato. So what happened? Eventually, one by one by one, all of the members of the Tziduki Sanhedrin disappear. U'ba'osu ha-yom sh'nistalku sanhedrin shel tzidukin v'yashva sanhedrin shel Yisrael asuhu yom tov. What do we do? Once the Tziduki Sanhedrin, one by one, they're gone. Of course, it's recorded that we did a Yom Tov, okay? The Purushi Sanhedrin, they re-emerge, and the Purushim now regain control of the Sanhedrin, and Asu Yom Tov, okay? Our next source, Megillas Tanis, we have another particular event in history with Alexander Yanai, as well as Queen Shlomzion. And this tells the story after the end of days, really, of Alexander Yanai and his conquest. We know Alexander Yanai extended the empire of the Hashmonai kingdom. He was a conqueror and, in some ways, a ruthless ruler. He also used non-Jewish hired mercenaries, which really bothered the Purushim. And gradually, he really isolated the Purushim. And in fact, there was a time, and we're gonna talk about it in our next source, there's a time in which the Purushim are actually going to have to flee because they're fearsome of what Alexander Yanai is going to do next to them. But at the same time, we do have a story about his wife. How does his wife fare with all of this? She is the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, after all. She did marry, initially, Aristobulus I, who himself was, in fact, most historians agree that he was a Purushi, and mild-mannered man, but he didn't live that long. So where does Queen Shlomzion fit in all of this? What effect did she have? Did she adhere to the will of her husband and try to kick out all the Purushim? Did she rule with an iron fist as well? Or did she have a different side to her? So we see here, and I'll do the underline. Rabosa Mamru, Isha Tova Haita Lo Liyana HaMelech, Bishlomin, Shema, because she made Silkah Tivato Me'al Yado V'Shachal Avitzar Usurim. So what happened? What did she do? Who was this queen? Well, the text describes the event that took place as Alexander Yanai is nearing death. He goes to the jail, and he says to, he imprisons, before he goes to jail, he imprisoned the tzaddikim of his day, okay? And he imprisons them, and he says to the tsar, he says to the officer in charge of the prisoners, when I die, I want you to kill all of these Pharisees. Why? Why would he do such a thing? Because he didn't want the day of his death to be a celebration. Because of course, after reigning for a time and chasing the Purushim out and trying on a gradual basis to once again introduce the Tziduki control of the Sanhedrin, he realized that when he died, the Purushim would be jumping up and down with joy. So instead, he wanted to make the day of his death into a day of mourning. How do you do that? Well, you kill the Purushim, okay? But what does his wife do? What does his wife do? So we see here, what does she do? She takes off his ring when he dies, doesn't tell anyone that he actually died, goes to the prison, says to the officer, look, this is my husband's signet ring, and he said to let them free. They're let free. Only after that does she go back and report that Alexander Yanai has died. But the Jews, the Pharisees, they're able to escape death. Okay, so we know clearly Shlomit Alexandra, Queen Shlom Tzion, does not want to see the death of the Pharisees in her era. We turn to the next source. And this is an interesting description or a recording in the Gemara, which discusses Ma'aseh B'Tziduki Echad, talks about one Tziduki, and it discusses the ceremony of Nisuch HaMayim, which takes place on Mochav. Sukkot, exactly. We're just finishing that Chag, so we should all be familiar to us, okay? And it describes a situation that occurred for Tziduki Echad. And what is the event that happens here? What did this Tziduki Echad do? Which, by the way, many will say is Alexander Yanai, okay? And it refers to the procedure of Nisuch HaMayim in the Beis HaMikdash. Shenisach al gabei raglav. Then he goes ahead and he takes the water and he pours it on his feet. Where is the water supposed to be poured on? The Mizbeach, exactly, okay? So what happens to him? Alexander Yanai is in the Beis HaMikdash, and we know the Chashmonai king is also the Kohen Gadol, okay? So the Kohen Gadol, who's supposed to do the service of Nisuch HaMayim, he goes ahead and takes the water, and as everybody's watching, and he's supposed to perform the ceremony properly according to halacha, the oral halacha, okay, and there's a dispute between Tzidukim and Purushim in terms of where the water is supposed to go, and what does he do as everybody's watching? Pours it on his feet, like the Tzidukim interpreted, not as per the Purushim explanation. And what do those who are standing there do? Exactly. They take their esrogim and they pelt Alexander Yanai with their esrogim, okay? And you see the unrest. You see that the Jews are just frustrated with the king. But that's only a little glimpse into what was happening in this era. So we know clearly that Alexander Yanai, this Tziduki Echad, okay, as he's referred to here, but we know that Alexander Yanai, yes, was trying to institute procedures within the Beis HaMikdash that went along with the Tziduki procedures and not according to the way that the Purushim. And what is the response of the people? So we'll look at the next source, okay? We'll look at Megillah Tzadis again. When Alexander Yanai descended to kill the sages, once again recorded, not only was he introducing Tziduki practices again, but he got so frustrated. They pelt me with their esrogim. They're not following my laws. They're not listening to me. So how does an Alexander Yanai rule? Well, when I march into a place and I want to conquer it, I kill those who are opposed to me. So what do? The sages are opposed to me, so I'm going to kill the sages. And when Alexander Yanai descends to kill the sages, they fled from him, turned to Syria, and dwelt in the province of Chalcis. I don't know where that location is. Are there enemies in that part of the country, although some say that it's Syria and possibly Lebanon as well. Their enemies in that part of the country attacked them murderously, caused much depredation among them, and smote them grievously, and there was left of them a remnant. Okay? So we know that under Alexander Yanai's rule, there were many of the sages who were slaughtered. We know that Shimon ben Jetach actually had to go in hiding as well. Many others went in hiding during this time. They were either smoked by Alexander Yanai or they went into hiding. Now, after this period, in terms of both Alexander Yanai slaughtering sages, trying to imprison them on the day of his death, giving over to the prison, the one who watched those Jews in the prison, the ability to kill them upon his death, we know that Queen Shlom Tzion was acting in a different vein. And that's where Josephus kind of helps us a little bit in this era, kind of filling in the details that we have from the Talmudic sources. We know Josephus, who himself was a Jewish traitor, unfortunately, who was a a general in the Jewish army, and then eventually we know in the period of the Great Revolt, when Josephus was supposed to be representing the Jewish people, and a general in the Jewish army actually goes over to the Roman side and he writes the history of the Jewish people, but he does so for the Romans. So when we read Josephus, we always have to keep that in mind. He is someone we look to for a source in this period to glean the history of the period. On the other hand, he was somebody who was in the Jewish camp and actually was a traitor and went over to the Roman side. So before introducing his words, I wanted to give that little disclaimer so that everyone has a little bit of background in terms of reading Josephus. But Josephus does describe an event that takes place, which kind of gives a glimpse again into this era, the power of Queen Shlonzion, and what was taking place between the Tzidukim and the Perushim, and who, in fact, had more of the power. Not only more of the power, but who had more of the goodwill of the people, the Perushim or the Tzidukim. So we'll read from this text, and I'm going to start with the second paragraph. But when his queen saw that he was ready to die and had no longer any hopes of surviving, she came to him weeping and lamenting, bewailed herself and her sons on the desolate condition that they should be left in, and said to him, "To whom dost thou thus leave me and my children, who are destitute of all other supports, and this when thou knowest how much ill will thy nation bears thee?" Okay, so we know Josephus records that clearly the nation disliked Alexander Yanai, strongly disliked Alexander Yanai. But he gave her the following advice, that she need but follow what he would suggest to her in order to retain the kingdom securely with her children, that she should conceal his death from the soldiers till she should have taken that place. After this, she should go in triumph as upon a victory to Jerusalem and put some of her authority into the hands of the Pharisees, for that they would commend her for the honor she had done them and would reconcile the nation to her, for he told her they had great authority among the Jews. Okay, so a few things from this text of Josephus. Number one, we see the same event that we talked about before in the source where she hid his death and then went to the prison, freed those who were imprisoned by Alexander Yanai, and then tells the world about his death. So we see in Josephus, he's kind of acknowledging that aspect that we have recorded before. In addition to that, he clearly recognizes the fact that he has gained the ill will of the people, because he tells her that to whom should she give the authority of the kingdom? To the Pharisees, to the Perushim. He realizes his wife is going to be left with his two sons, and he has created a situation in which the people, not only do they pelt him with esrogim, but there actually was a Jewish uprising during his day where the Pharisees were aggravated by all those changes that he had done, by allowing non-Jews to fight in order to conquer the land, by enforcing Siddiqui law within the Sanhedrin, within the Beis HaMikdash. So what does he tell her? Give your authority, put some of her authority into the hands of the Pharisees. And that is what is going to help you. We'll continue reading. Both to do hurt to such as they hated and to bring advantages to those to whom they were friendly disposed, for that they are then believed best of all by the multitude when they speak any severe thing against others, though it be only out of envy at them. Okay, so once again, not only do the Pharisees have the control, but what type of control do they have? True. Absolutely. You're correct in stating that Josephus is recording an event that he did not live through. However, he is recording very much of the tone and what we know of what existed in that era. We know for sure that the Perushim had the control of the masses. As we said, the peasantry, those who were poor, not living, not the city dwellers, were very much in tune with adhering Torah law, strict Torah law. In fact, we started out with the miracle of Hanukkah. How did we win? How did we beat the Greeks? How was it possible? We beat them because we were fighting for our land. We beat them because we were fighting for what our land represented, adherence to Torah, strict adherence to Torah. And then we see in this period of Alexander Yanai, we have when the Jews have political and spiritual control, and yet we have a Jewish king who is saying to the Pharisees, not only am I not going to adhere to your law, but I'm going to kill you. So you're right, Alexander Yanai could not possibly have recorded the conversation, but he does pick up the tone of the Jews in the day, correctly assessing that the Pharisees clearly had a much larger control over the Jewish people. And when they would say something, the majority of the Jews, other than the wealthy urban city dwellers who were very much influenced by Greek culture, when the Pharisees said, this is not l'halacha, this king should not be someone who's leading the procedures in the Beis HaMikdash, the Jews would listen. We'll read further, and then we can discuss the other issue in terms of Shlom Tzion, which we'll decide together. Was she Pharisee, or was she really Tzaduki? Okay, after reading the sources, it's up to you to decide. So let's go on. And he said that it was by their means that he had incurred the displeasure of the nation, whom indeed he had injured. Do thou therefore, said he, when thou art come to Jerusalem, and send for the leading men among them, and show them my body, and with great appearance of sincerity, give them leave to use it as they themselves please, whether they will dishonor the dead body by refusing it burial, as having severely suffered by my means, or whether in their anger they will offer any other injury to that body. Promise them also that thou wilt do nothing without them in the affairs of the kingdom. If thou dost but say this to them, I shall have the honor of a more glorious funeral from them than thou could have made for me. And when it is in their power to abuse my dead body, they will do it no injury at all, and thou wilt rule in safety. Okay, the last part is very much a telling aspect. What does Alexander Yanai realize if he gives his body over to the Perushim, even though he killed the sages, even though he changed the way, or he's trying to enforce Hellenism, trying to enforce the ways of the Tzidukim upon the Perushim, and he did so with a heavy hand? What does he think the Perushim are going to do with his body when given the opportunity to give him a burial? They will bury him, okay? What would happen, however, had Alexander Yanai done the same to the Tzidukim, and he handed his body over to the Tzidukim to bury? What do you suppose would have happened to his body then? Most likely would have been injured, most likely would not have been given the burial. But he recognizes that the Perushim, once given the opportunity to bury the body, even if this individual had done harms galore, they were going to give him the proper burial. So when he had given his wife this advice, he died after he had reigned 27 years at the age of 49. Okay, so we know, once again, this is obviously an account that Josephus couldn't have witnessed. It's not a first-hand account that he's recorded. It's not a primary document in terms of being a recording or a deposition testimony of somebody stating the events that actually occurred during that era. But it is giving us a glimpse into what took place. And it does tell us exactly the way that the Jews were living, what the society was like, wherein we know the Perushim had a much larger control. Now, what happens to Queen Shlom Tzion afterwards? Okay, so the question was posed in terms of, was she really a closet Tzaduki? And when, you know, Alexander Yanai realizes she's going to need all the help she needs, she moves over to the Perushi camp? Or was she somebody who was struggling because her brother was Shimon ben Shetach, and there are accounts stating that she hid her brother when he needed to hide from Alexander Yanai, and not only her brother, but other sages as well? We also know that once she had the ability to rule, not only did she give the Perushim the control that Alexander Yanai instructed her to do, but we have what's referred to as a quasi-golden age under her rule, in the sense that the halacha was kept to, the Sanhedrin was under Perushi control, the Beis HaMikdash functioned under Perushi control, and the services were once again restored the way they had been, flourishing under Pharisee control. So obviously, you know, you can decide on your own reading the sources which way you feel Queen Shlomi Alexandra Shlomtzion, as she's referred to in different sources, which way she was headed, or which direction she began, which direction she ended up. But either way, we know that there's a medrash in Vayikra Rabbah which talks about the concept of rain falling in the right time. When it says rain falls in the right time, what does that mean? Does anybody know? We talk about rain falling the right time when it rains on a particular day, Friday night, exactly. The Medrash records that that occurs during the 9 years that Queen Shlomtzion reigned. Okay? So we have, not only do we have Josephus picking up the fact that she goes ahead and rules under Pharisee control, but we also have later on Midrashic sources, Tanaitic sources, all looking at Queen Shlomtzion as somebody who joined the Pharisee camp and that the Jews flourished under her reign. We'll continue with looking at the Zugot, and I have here recorded just the names of the Zugot so you have somewhat of a concept in terms of what era the Jews had these particular rulers. When you read the Mishnah and Avos and the beginnings talk about these individuals, Yosef ben Yoezer, Yosef ben Yochanan, kind of can put them into historical context in terms of when they lived. So after Shimon ben Shetach, who lived during Alexander Yanai's rule, we have Shemaya and Avtalion, who were the Zugot end of the Hashmonai era until King Herod's reign, and then of course Hillel and Shammai, probably the most famous of the pairs, who rule, were the Av Beit Din and the Nasi during King Herod's reign. We have to go back to our chart now, though, after we discussed the queen herself and which direction she led the Jews, again, with different sources pulling her in different directions. But most of them agree that under her reign, whether she willingly and wanted to become a Pharisee, she did either way. And again, Judaism flourished when she led the Jewish people as queen. But what happens after her demise? What happens after her death? And this is a sad part of Jewish history. This is the sad part of the Hashmonai era. We get to the point where we celebrate the miracle of Hanukkah. We have the victory not only over the Greeks, but we have the victory over Hellenism. And then the Hashmonai era is a struggle. It's a battle. It's a battle between the culture. It's a battle between us being able to sustain ourselves both within the Jewish world and accepting modernity, but not going too much into the culture and losing what we hold strong. And what happens after her reign? Well, she has two children, two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. And this is an era in which we bring in outside help, each of these individuals, each of these children. Neither one of them is left with security. Their mother, Queen Shlomtzion, does not say, you are going to be king, you are going to be Kohen Gadol, or one of you is going to be the ethnarch. It's kind of iffy. She leaves it a little bit iffy as to which one should, in fact, reign after her. And of course, what happens? They fight each other, okay? And this is an infamous Jewish civil war that begins in 68 BCE. Now, what do these brothers do in order to gain control of the kingdom? Well, unfortunately, they both in turn will try to make alliances. And their alliances will take them out of the land of Israel into countries that surround the land of Israel. One in particular is going to be the conquering country that at the end of the Civil War, although these brothers thought that they were going to be helped by the Idumeans or the Romans, neither of them were successful. In fact, once the Romans pick up on the unrest in Judea, they realize that brothers, not figuratively speaking, but literally Jewish brothers are killing each other. This is our time to take over Judea once and for all. And it's at that point, by the time we reach 63 BCE, Pompey marches in and conquers Judea. And the period that we had, where we had political and religious autonomy, when we were under Hashmonai rule, when we had the ability to have the Beis HaMikdash under our control, the land of Israel under our control, it ends. And it ends because two Jewish brothers fight each other for the throne. And I say a sad part of history. It's a sad part of history because what led to the demise of Judea? Unfortunately, the unrest, the internal unrest, the sinas chinam, the real hatred between two brothers, Now, of course, one of these brothers made an alliance with the Siddiqui camp. One of the other brothers made an alliance with the Purushi camp. So in addition to having the battle going on between the two brothers, another battle is also being fought alongside. Once again, we have the battle between the Siddiqui Jews and the Purushi Jews, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. An unfortunate aspect of history is that when the Jews are at our weakest point, when we're fighting each other, that's when the rest of the world says, this is a nice time to issue a persecution. When we don't have a unified voice is when the Jews can't muster enough strength to combat the environment around us. So that is what we hope will not be repeated in the period that we are in now, where we have the political control, where we have the spiritual control. But unfortunately, how many times do you open up, you know, your Israeli newspaper and you read about, unfortunately, this conflict between this, and I don't even want to name names every time I think of classifying Jews as this way or that way or this way or that way, but it gives me the chills every time I think about it, because for me, I immediately, you know, think back to the period in history before when we had political and spiritual autonomy, and then brothers were fighting each other, and then what happens? Rome marches in and says, you guys can't deal with each other? No problem, we'll take over, have fun. So that's the fear. That's the fear, you know, that we have to, not only the fear, but something that we have to learn from history, that brothers shouldn't be fighting each other. Whether it's the Siddiqui versus the Purushi, whether it's who should be king, who should be Kohen Gadol, bottom line is God gave us our land. We have the land. We have to focus on our land, Torah, adherence to Torah, and not the conflicts that are between us. And I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to just conclude on another note. Something that always, I guess, living in the American society, we all are bombarded with the Halloween decorations, and then after Halloween, we have the Thanksgiving decorations, and then you have the Christmas decorations, and then you have the presents that are all around, and sometimes, I guess, it's very easy to be influenced. You know, how large a Hanukkah party should I make? How many presents should I buy my children? And we get focused on the society that we're in. But sometimes we have to take a step back and realize, what was Hanukkah all about? What were we fighting against? What was the victory? We were fighting against the Hellenism. We were fighting against the materialism that was infusing our society. Matisyahu and his sons and the Jews, they stood up against the acculturation, the idea that culture should start impacting our lives. That's what they were fighting against. The miracle was, yes, of course, they wanted to take over the Siddiqui control, and unfortunately, the background of the Siddiqui was there, but they were also fighting a battle, it was a constant battle, which is a battle that we face in every country, in every society. So when we think about Hanukkah, we have to always keep in mind, we're celebrating the miracle of the oil, we're celebrating the battle. We also have to think of what the battle was about. The battle was about the culture, about not letting the culture around us influence, you know, the presents we buy our children or the size of the Hanukkah party we have. But the idea is that we adhere to Torah and mitzvot and really celebrate the spirituality, the spiritual aspect of Hanukkah, the miracle of lights, the impact that it had on us in the spiritual sense as well. So I'm going to take questions. Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. So we ended today with 63 BCE when Rome takes over. The story of Masada is going to take place during the Great Revolt, which begins in 67 CE and continues along until 73 CE. So during the period of the Great Revolt, when the Jews are revolting against the Roman authority, that's when the story of Masada occurs. Yes, that's exactly when Josephus was writing, when he lived. So when we say that he was not living during this era, absolutely was not living during this era, but he was recording the history that was before him. And he was a general during the Great Revolt, and he went over to the Roman camp when his life was threatened. The story of Masada could have been Josephus, but instead of killing himself and others, he actually sides with the Romans and goes over to their camp. Yeah. Yes, there is. True. There is Queen Shlom Tzion HaMalka, Rehov Queen Shlom Tzion. That is a good question. Does anybody know of a street called Hyrcanus or Aristobulus in Israel? We know there's a queen, there's a Rehov Queen Shlomzion Hamalka. The question is there a Rehov Aristobulus or Rehov Hyrcanus? Rehov Alexander Yanai, that's your Rehov Yanai. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah. That's definitely a point you could take out of the Josephus account, when recognizing that if you wanted to do Torah right, you did go over to the Pharisee camp. Yeah. Sorry? I can hear you. That's true. That's true. Okay, any other questions? Yeah. Okay, if you have more questions, thank you all.
Thank you.